This is Sidedoor, a podcast from the Smithsonian with support from PRX. I'm Tony Cohn. Hi, Sidedoorians. Are we trying to make that a thing now? Sidedoorians?
I don't know.
Okay, so we've been working on this week's story for a while, and to kick it off, I brought Sidedoor producer Justin O'Neill. Say hello again, Justin.
Hey, guys.
To play a bit of audio for us. Okay, so Justin, what are we hearing?
So I recently visited this mosque, and it was a bit of a drive, so I got there just before the midday prayer. And what we just heard was their call to prayer. And that's how they start their prayers.
Can you, like, paint the picture for me a little bit?
Yeah, so this mosque, or masjid, which just means mosque in Arabic, it was a small, easy-to-miss building off the side of this really fast-moving two-lane road, like, you know, the kind that the speed limit, like, should be 20 miles an hour lower than it actually is. That
what,
was this
what
one.
Is that, what does that even mean?
Well, it means I drove past it twice. And so once I got to the building and got inside...
Because third time's the charm.
Third time's the charm.
Pleasure to meet you.
Pleasure to meet you. Thanks for having me.
And the visit was really nice. It was fun. They seemed genuinely, like, happy we were interested in like, what they had to say. So before the prayer, the imam pulled me aside and just gave me sort of a heads up of, like, what to expect that afternoon.
Okay. And then we'll ask you to introduce yourself and kind of how best we can facilitate. I said four or five, but word kind of got around and some of our security's here. So it's a little bit bigger group.
But all right.
So it was a bigger group of people than what you expected to find?
Yeah, it was a bigger group, but that's, you know, they were excited and I was excited, so it was all good.
And the man sounds Southern, so where were you for all this?
Well, yeah, I was in Fayetteville, North Carolina. And if people don't know Fayetteville, they might know Fort Bragg, the big army base. We were about a 15-minute drive from there. And this community is in the South, so full of Southern American Muslims.
Yeah, I feel like Americans often focus on Muslims as immigrants. We hear less about American-born Muslims, people who were born in the U.S. and practice Islam.
Exactly. No, I agree totally. So after the prayer, the current imam, the former imam...
What is an imam?
Oh, yeah. So imam is just like the mosque's religious leader. Think of it as Islam's version of like a rabbi or a priest.
Okay.
So I sat down to talk with some of the mosque's elders about what it's like being Muslim in America. Here's what Imam Abdul Hamid Thomas told me. And to him, it seems pretty straightforward.
You know, I like to use this expression, we're as American as it gets. We're Americans, but we're Muslim Americans. But you do have Muslims who think we should come to Friday prayer on a camel because Muhammad went to Friday prayer on a camel. But no, I'm going to drive my F-150 truck because that's what I'm driving now. That's what I'm riding on.
Which brings me to the reason why I was there. So the mosque in Fayetteville is called Masjid Omar Ibn Said. It was named after a Muslim man who lived around Fayetteville in the early 1800s. And it turns out that he had an interesting and really hard life, which you've done some interviews about.
We started looking into Omar Ibn Said's story when we learned that around the time the U.S. became a country, back in the late
1700s. 1776.
Very good, 1776. The population was likely around 5% Muslim.
I remember finding that 5% figure really surprising when we first heard it.
Well, I thought it was even more surprising when I learned that today only 1% of the population is Muslim.
Right. But in many ways, these early American Muslims have been essentially forgotten. Millions of people, like Omar, who are here in the earliest days of the country and whose influence still resonates today.
Which is why we did a lot of research to find American history's missing Muslims. The people that were here, but that most of us didn't really learn about in school. So this time on Sidedoor, we look at Islam in early America through the eyes and words of Omar Ibn Said. And we ask the question, how did Islam get here? What happened to America's earliest Muslims? And what does it mean for Americans of all faiths and races today? All of that after a quick break. Hey, Sidedoor listeners, it's Tony here with a quick message from one of our sponsors. From the creators of Missing Maura Murray and Crawl Space comes Empty Frames, a new investigative podcast aiming to find answers to one of the biggest mysteries the world has ever seen. In the early morning hours of March 18, 1990, the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum in Boston, Massachusetts, fell victim to the most audacious art heist in modern history. In 81 minutes, two thieves dressed as policemen made off with 13 pieces of artwork, with an estimated value of $500 million. In Empty Frames, Tim and Lance from the popular true crime podcasts Missing Maura Murray and Crawl Space will dive into the case, exploring all angles. Along with investigators, reporters, art theft experts, and citizens, they paint their own portrait comprised of the theories and the social and economic impacts of the greatest unsolved art heist of all time. Search and subscribe to Empty Frames today on Apple Podcasts or the app of your choice. Omar Ibn Said's story starts in what is now Senegal, in Western Africa.
At the time, it was called Senegambia, so Senegal and the Gambia.
That's Peter Manso, the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History's religion curator. Senegal is on North Africa's Atlantic coast. We don't know a lot about Said's life there, but here's what we do know. We know that he was born around 1770.
We do know that he was an educated man. He was a man of some esteem within his community. He tithed. He had enough resources to share his resources with those who had less than him. He was a man knowledgeable in his faith, in the Islamic faith, so much so that he was able to serve as a leader and instructor of children in his community.
But this man who was respected in his community was about to have his life torn apart. Omar was 37 years old. He had a family, brothers, sisters. He had enough money to share with the local mosque. But then, everything changed. An army invaded. He was kidnapped, passed from one group of captors to another. They spoke a language he didn't. It must have been terrifying. They marched him for days by force. They ended up at an ocean. Then Omar was forced onto a boat. After 6 weeks crossing the Atlantic, he ended up in Charleston, South Carolina. Like so many before and so many after him, Omar Ibn Said was sold into slavery. In a cruel twist of history, Omar would have been on one of the last ships to sell people into slavery in the U.S. before it banned the transatlantic slave trade in 1808. And here's how Omar described what happened next in an account that he wrote much later in life.
"And in a Christian language, they sold me, a weak, small, evil man called Johnson, an infidel, who did not fear Allah at all, bought me. I am a small man who cannot do hard work. I escaped from the hands of Johnson after a month."
Omar fled from Charleston. He slept during the day and ran at night. And still, he prayed 5 times a day in accordance with his faith. He walked 200 miles until he ended up just south of Fayetteville, North Carolina. Here's Peter again.
"And finally, on what he recalls in his telling of his own life story, on a new moon night, he went into what he referred to as a great house, just a large building that he saw, which seems to have been a church. And he happened to go in there to say the Muslim prayers for the new moon. And he did not realize, but a local boy had seen him go into this church, who alerted his father. They came with reinforcements and they recaptured him at that point, and he was arrested and put into the jail in Fayetteville."
In his jail cell, Omar found a piece of charcoal, and he used the big blank cell wall as a canvas. It's hard to imagine what must have been going through his mind. Was it rage? Frustration? Passion? Either way, he filled the walls with Arabic script.
"Most likely verses from the Quran. And this is such a spectacle in Fayetteville, North Carolina, that people begin to come to see this."
In 1810, people in North Carolina were accustomed to having enslaved Africans around. They made up about 30% of the state's population. That's more than 550,000 enslaved people. But what they weren't used to was an enslaved person creating beautiful writing on a jail cell wall, reproducing centuries-old texts from memory. Slave owners at the time told themselves stories that justified slavery and white supremacy. They'd say that the African people that they exploited came from tribal societies that had no culture. They'd say that they were uneducated. But Omar's ornate script on the jail cell wall shows the truth behind all of those lies. If slave owners could put those facts together, it would likely have been very troubling.
He starts to gather a crowd, so much so that the sheriff of Fayetteville, Sheriff Mumford, wonders what he should do with this very curious escaped slave that he's found.
Sheriff Mumford knew one thing. He had to get this guy away from his jail.
Eventually, Mumford decides that he needs to take him out of the jail where he's causing quite a commotion. He brings him to his own home.
After a few days with the sheriff, when nobody comes forward to claim Omar, Sheriff Mumford gives or sells, it's not quite clear, Omar to the Owen family because Mumford's daughter was married to James Owen.
Former general in the War of 1812, brother of John Owen, who was later a governor of North Carolina.
And Omar ibn Said ends up living with the Owen family for a long time.
Omar ibn Said at that point becomes, at least according to later tellings, a trusted and nearly beloved member of the Owen family. He goes to church with the Owen family.
There are also hard-to-verify accounts of Omar entertaining the Owen kids by telling them stories, which shows he had a pretty intimate relationship with the family.
He is, according to later accounts, not given a lot of hard work to do because he's thought to be very fragile in his disposition.
And the way that Omar describes his life, well, okay, we'll let you decide yourself how it sounds. And just a side note, Omar was writing in Arabic, so obviously this is a translation. In fact, it ended up taking 17 years to even translate his autobiography.
O people of America, all of you, are there among you men as good as Jim Owen and John Owen? They are good men, for whatever they eat, I eat. Whatever they wear, they give me to wear.
In another place, he says this about living with the Owen family.
I continue in the hands of Jim Owen, who does not beat me, nor calls me bad names, nor subjects me to hunger, nakedness, or hard work. During the last 20 years, I have not seen any harm at the hands of Jim Owen.
He's a man living under enslavement, and so I think he's trying to make a life, trying to survive in any way he can. And so if his life can become slightly more comfortable by converting to Christianity, by joining the Presbyterian church that the Owen family were members of, then certainly I think we can understand why one would take those practical steps. So in the 1830s, he is asked to write the story of his life in Arabic, which is the only language he could write in.
We need to pause the Omar ibn Said story here for a second to just get a few things straight. Omar wrote down his life story in an autobiography, and a lot of the things that we know about him today come from this very document. That's why historians love Omar ibn Said.
He is the only one we know, the only enslaved Muslim we know, who was able to write an account of his life in Arabic that we still have. And though the telling of his story is singular, it most likely represents many others with similar experiences.
Slavery was a racist system designed to strip people of their humanity, their culture, and their history. In 1830, about 13% of the U.S. population was enslaved, which works out to be a little over 2 million people. If you grew up in the United States, you're probably saying something like, yeah, Tony, I've learned that before. But here's what you might not know. Many of those people came from near Omar's home in West Africa, where 20 to 40% of the population was Muslim. So that means there were a lot of Muslims in the United States during the centuries that this country enslaved people.
Somewhere during the presidential campaign of 2016, Hillary Clinton happened to mention during a debate this idea that Islam has been in America for longer than many people know. I think she even mentioned that Muslims have been in America since George Washington, what was the phrase that she used. And I know that only because PolitiFact chose to fact check this, and they ended up referencing something that I had written within their fact check, which was basically to say, yes, of course, this is obviously true. But what I keep thinking about is why and how did that even become something that becomes open to question. It's something that is entirely uncontroversial among historians. It's something that is obvious within the historical record. And yet, for some reason, we have forgotten it. We know less about that fact of our history than we did 150 years ago.
Manso says that part of the reason many people don't know that Islam was brought to America through slavery is the fact that it was common practice for slave owners to force the people they enslaved to adopt Christianity.
And it's helpful to remember that when we think of the experience of slavery overall, which over time entirely strips those religious perspectives that enslaved men and women brought with them. It's important to remember that there were social and cultural reasons why that is happening. And Omar Ibn Said, his story is a very dramatic way of reminding ourselves of that.
But what Omar performed in public isn't a complete reflection of what he thought and felt. What happened between him and his God was one of the few things under his control.
We really need to accept a nuanced an appreciation of the inner lives of slaves and their relation to their community.
This is Ala Arrayas. He's a literature professor at Queens College in New York City, and he's written a book about Omar Ibn Said's autobiography. And Arrayas has spent years thinking about what Omar wrote. Words like these.
Now I pray in the words of our Lord Jesus the Messiah. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come.
Yes, that's the Christian Lord's Prayer, also known as the Our Father. But Omar had written it in his autobiography in Arabic.
So let's talk about the actual autobiography for a second. Can you give me the high-level SparkNote version?
Sure. The manuscript itself, what Omar wrote, consists of two parts. First, a chapter from the Quran, which he may have reproduced from memory. It's called in Arabic Surat al-Mulk, and Surah is the Arabic word for a Quranic chapter. And then it's followed by the autobiography, the details of his life.
Here's what Omar quoted from the Surat al-Mulk, the Quran's 67th chapter.
Now, I blessed be he in whose hand is the Mulk, and who has power over all things. He created death and life, that he might put you to the proof and find out which of you had the best work. He is the mighty, the forgiving one.
The word mulk in Arabic means possession or dominion, and it is a sort of the perfect reference to slavery, almost as a speech act to kind of discredit or to disallow slavery, since the text of the surah is that it's only God who has ownership of persons and things.
Arrayas asks, which was it? Did Omar believe in Islam or Christianity? Omar often quotes the Quran, but also writes about Jesus, the Christian Messiah who the Owen family, the family who is said to own Omar, encouraged Omar to embrace. They were Presbyterian, and since Omar wasn't a free man, he became Presbyterian too.
So I think what he was able to do was to really negotiate a place for him within the sort of cultural needs that he faced without really converting in the sense that his masters and others thought. But he was able to use the fact that Islam itself accepts a lot of the tenets of Christianity and certainly regards Jesus as a great prophet. And so it was not a contradiction for him to go to church. I don't think he saw that as necessarily contradicting his remaining a Muslim.
So what he's saying is that some historians argue that Omar followed the taqiyya, the Muslim tradition that lets people conceal their faith when they're in danger. Others say, yeah, he probably converted. Arrayas takes the middle ground. He thinks Omar drew spiritual sustenance from both faiths. A lot of this might seem like it's a little academic, but it's actually a rare glimpse into the emotional life of a Muslim who is enslaved in the United States. Most enslaved people left very little behind, that's in their own words.
Slavery is a grave historical crime, and so many slaves are lost to history. And it seems to me, I mean, we have certain archaeological artifacts, we have certain things that we know certain things about what they ate and what they wore, but it's much harder to individualize them. And it seemed to me when I came across this narrative, there was something about it that was in need of bringing to light. It was a complex story, but a completely American story.
After a quick break, we hear the rest of Omar Ibn Said's story and look at Islam in modern America.
How would you like even more side door access? Join our email list for bonus content from our episodes directly from Tony. You'll even get to hear from the Smithsonian's global network of experts conducting critical research, making astonishing discoveries, and designing awe-inspiring exhibitions. It's like having a VIP badge to our podcast, perfect for curious, passionate people like you. Visit si.edu/sidedoor to sign up today. That's si.edu/sidedoor.
Welcome back. So we just threw a lot of history and analysis at you, but here's where we are with Omar Ibn Said's story. He was a well-educated Muslim from West Africa who was sold into slavery in South Carolina. Omar escaped, but was eventually caught near Fayetteville, North Carolina, and was either sold or given to the Owen family, with whom he would live for over 50 years. He was forced to convert to Christianity, outwardly, but it's thought that he held on to Islam, his original faith. Oh, and he wrote an autobiography, and while it's not the story of every enslaved individual in America, it is the only first-person account historians have found written by an enslaved Muslim. But while Omar Ibn Said was living his life and just trying to survive, there were many powerful examples of what could happen as a result of forcing people to work for free against their will. Smithsonian religion historian Peter Manceau says that around this time, there were a couple of very high-profile slave revolts that made slave-owning Americans paranoid. One was the long, bloody Haitian Revolution that ended in 1804, in which enslaved people decided, yeah, we've had enough of this. They freed themselves, killed the slave owners, and anyone who sympathized with them. They declared independence as the world's only country liberated and ruled by former enslaved people. Another revolt happened in Brazil, and it was sensationalized in the American press. In 1835, in the Brazilian city of Salvador de Bahia, a small group of enslaved people and freedmen inspired by Muslim teachers rose up against the government, not just slave owners. While authorities were tipped off about the revolt in advance, several hundred enslaved Muslim Africans attacked police and army barracks, as well as a jail. The revolt only lasted a few hours, but slave owners around the hemisphere freaked out. Here's Peter.
It really suggests, through the accounts of this slave revolt that spread throughout the United States around this time, that there was this fear of a kind of holy war on slave plantations. This idea, if you allow Islam to maintain its presence, that it could have this kind of effect. And so Omar Ibn Said's story is told as a way of suggesting that we can solve this problem by the conversion of our slaves.
There were many other slave revolts closer to home, and some were inspired by religion. Nat Turner's radical interpretation of the Bible, for example, led to an 1831 uprising in Virginia and resulted in the deaths of about 60 white people and 120 enslaved people. Although these revolts left many slave owners paranoid, the Owen family seemed to trust Omar. Violence was not Omar's style. Here's another quote from Omar's autobiography.
General Jim Owen and his wife used to read the Bible to me a lot. Allah is our Lord, our Creator, and our owner, and the restorer of our condition, health, and wealth. According to my ability, open my heart to the Bible, to the path of righteousness.
And Omar lived a long time with the Owen family.
He lives to be almost 100 years old, and certainly most slaves did not have that opportunity. So there does seem to be some validity to the claim that the Owen family treated him well, at least as far as his longevity suggests. But again, he remained a slave to the Owen family through his whole life.
Omar living into his 90s is incredible, especially considering just 15% of enslaved people in 1860 were over 40 years old. Even though Omar Ibn Said's story is unique in many ways, I mean, after all, he wrote an autobiography and lived almost a century, he was like other enslaved Muslims as well. He was forced to convert to Christianity, and he died without freedom.
Islam of this kind was eventually eradicated. Christianity becomes a significant part of the experience of African Americans, such that within a generation or two, you can't find much evidence of Islam among the enslaved anymore, and certainly not after the Civil War, when with emancipation there's a greater effort to convert former slaves to Christianity.
To historians, there are lasting impacts. African Muslims fought alongside American rebels during the Revolutionary War. Thomas Jefferson studied the Quran and argued for Muslim, Hindu, Jewish, and even pagan civil rights. Although their religion was stamped out, some traditions of enslaved Muslims were blended into broader African-American culture.
There are some scholars who point to, example, some oral resonance between the call to prayer and blues music, for example.
Well, Lord, oh, Allah.
Which are persuasive, but that's not really the point. The point is that this tradition was here, this religious perspective was here. And so even if we cannot immediately identify the way that its vestiges have carried on, it's equally part of the American experience. And that's the point that's important to remember, that simply because it changed forms or it's hard to see does not mean that it has not been influential in the religious history of America.
Several generations after Omar's death, Islam was effectively wiped out from America's religious landscape. It wasn't until the middle of the 20th century, in the midst of the civil rights era, that a significant number of African Americans, including celebrities like Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Malcolm X, and Muhammad Ali, began to convert to Islam, seeking a connection with their past that had been erased.
I don't know if I'm going to fight again or not. I'm going to retire as of now. I have to talk to my leader, the most honorable.
Are you still planning to retire?
As-salamu alaykum to all the Muslims. Thanks to Almighty God Allah. I want all of you fans out there who believe in me, go to your local Muslim temple and learn more about the life-giving power.
In the meantime, small number of Muslim immigrants from around the world had trickled into different parts of the country. Which brings us to the present day, where we can find vibrant communities of African-American Muslims in places like Fayetteville, North Carolina, at Masjid Omar Ibn Said, which was founded in 1981. Back in Fayetteville with Imam Abdul Hamid Thomas, at a masjid named for Omar Ibn Said, they know about Islam's early roots in America because it's their history, too.
I like to tell this brief story because I was in a restaurant a few years ago, and a gentleman was carrying on conversations with people at his table, seemingly at every table. He was just a jolly guy. He was talking loud enough so I could hear him clearly. He was talking about this Prince Moro.
Omar Ibn Said had a lot of nicknames, including Prince Moro or Uncle Moro.
So I caught up with him before he left. He told me a little bit more about where he was from.
The man told the imam the location of the old Owen plantation, where Omar had lived so many years ago. So naturally, being a member of a masjid named after Omar, this made the imam curious.
I said, where is this place? And he gave me a general location of where the old plantation was. So I got a group of brothers. We traveled down to that location. We walked into the woods. From what I can recall, there was just a lot of overgrowth and a few old farmhouses. Not much, just woodland. But what was humbling to me that day was when Adam said...
Adam Bia is a member and former imam of Masjid Omar Ibn Said.
Let's offer al-Fatiha right here on these grounds.
The Surat al-Fatiha is the first chapter of the Quran. It's essentially a prayer that asks for guidance.
When we finished the prayer, the opening prayer of the Quran, he said, this is probably the first time Al-Fatiha has been recited since Omar last recited it on these grounds. And that really was touching to me to know that that probably was in fact the truth.
It doesn't matter to them if Omar converted to Christianity. To this group, sitting around folding tables in Fayetteville, laughing, sharing stories of their faith and their country, in many ways, they're the living legacy of those first Muslims who were brought to the United States against their will. Because the community at Masjid Omar Ibn Said know who they are. They're Muslim Americans.
You know, I'm almost feeling a little guilty that you stayed as long as you did because we would have prepared for you a good Muslim lunch. And you could have went back and said you had some real country Muslim food. And they would say, what did they feed you? We'd say probably some fried chicken, mashed potatoes, and good old country collard greens, sweet potatoes. And people would have said, that's not Muslim food. You said, it is now.
You've been listening to Side Door, a podcast from the Smithsonian with support from PRX. If you want to learn more about the history of different religions in American history, there is an exhibit at the American History Museum called Religions in Early America. It has a lot of artifacts from early American history, like Thomas Jefferson's Bible, a Torah scroll on loan from one of New York City's oldest Jewish congregations, as well as an image of Omar ibn Said. The exhibition closes on June 3rd, 2018. For this episode, we're very much in debt to two books, Ella Arraeus's A Muslim American Slave, The Life of Omar ibn Said, and Peter Manceau's One Nation Under Gods, A New American History. We could not have done this episode without both of them. We wanted to give a special thank you to Imam Talib Sharif for giving voice to Omar ibn Said, and for extra research and fact-checking by Peter Manceau, Ayla Ammon, Stacia Brown, Barbara Rehm, and the community at Masjid Omar ibn Said. Our podcast team is Justin O'Neill, Rachel Aronoff, Jason Orfanin, Gabe Kozowitz, Jess Sadek, Greg Fisk, Nico Picaro, and Elizabeth Pilger. Extra support comes from John Barth and Genevieve Sponsler. I'm your host, Tony Cohn. Thanks for listening.